Welcome to Buddhism in a Nutshell. This is your wonderful teacher, Elise. And I just pop into the first class of everything we do, like Buddhism in a Nutshell, Meditation 101, each module of Discovering Buddhism. So if you've heard my spiel, you can take a little nap and wake up again in a second. So I'm Jill Marie, the new center manager here. And just wanted to introduce myself and say welcome to the class. And has anybody taken anything here? Let's see, have you had Meditation 101 before? No, you have. Oh, you got a bunch of new people. And then any Discovering Buddhism? Nope. Yep, a little bit back in the back. Good. So it's all kind of new to you. So I just wanted to offer a piece of information that we don't charge for anything here. You might have noticed that if you called in, I might have answered the questions. But it's unusual for the whole world, even, that we don't charge for any of the teachings. So everything's a donation basis. So I always want to encourage people that if you do want to consider donating, you can put a check in the box, you can donate online, whatever you feel moved to do. And is that everything? I think you go over tea and coffee and bathrooms and all that.
I don't know about the tea coffee thing.
Oh, but you can just, if you ever want to get a cup of tea or do anything, you can feel free to get up. It's a laid-back atmosphere. So any questions? All right, we'll have fun.
Great class.
Well, welcome. Thank you all for being here tonight. I know that there's a big representation from Athens Drive High School. You're here for a class tonight, all of you on the floor. And I want to let you know that if your legs start to tingle, it's okay to get up and move to a chair even during the night. So as Jill mentioned, I will let you know that the bathrooms are essentially behind this yellow wall. So at any time you need to use them, feel free to get up and go do that, get a drink or whatever you need to do. My name is Elise Strivel. It's up here. And I am also the outreach coordinator here at Kadampa Center. So if you have any questions about this course or anything else that you think I can be of help to you, you can always email me at that outreach at kadampa-center.org. So Jill just asked who has been here before. Who has never been in this center before? Wow. Well, thank you all so much for your curiosity and for coming out here tonight. And I know this is a really different environment to be sitting in, isn't it? And so with so many people being here for the first time, has anybody who has even not been here before become familiar with Buddhism from some other classes or other place? So you have a little bit. And you have. Great. You did it here. Did you do this? You came into one of these classes before? Okay. Well, this is really in a nutshell. So in 5 weeks, we're going to try and cover the very basics of Buddhism, and it really is just skimming the top. So even though I'm going to try to keep this very simple and very practical and comprehensive, understandable, there will be some very strange ideas and words. So please don't hesitate to ask questions during the session or afterward. Please feel free to come on in. Come on in. Okay. Now, the first thing we usually do for any class, any gathering together, is to set our intention for the night. Now, all of you could have been anywhere else here tonight. You all have busy lives, you work, go to school. It took some effort to get here through the traffic and will continue to be a problem as the fair moves on here next week. But you made the effort to come here. Now, we all, that you had some reason for being here, whether it's just curiosity or trying to find some way to answer questions that remain unanswered in your minds and your lives. So let us set our intention that we'll work together and try to help one another gain a little insight into ourselves in order to make ourselves better for the rest of the world. Okay. Let's see if this thing will work. Okay, so our plan for tonight, we're going to have a little introduction to the Kadampa Center here. Please come on in. We're just started. You haven't missed anything. We're going to talk a little bit about what this class will be. We're going to talk a little bit about Buddha and the Four Noble Truths and have a brief introduction to meditation. So, first, here's my disclaimer. What I know about Buddhism. The green part is from research. The blue is from school or classes. The yellow is from other Buddhist people. And the rust color is the Simpsons episode where Lisa becomes a Buddhist. But not really, of course. I have been actually coming to this center since 2004. And I am not a professional. I am not ordained. I am just a lay person, just someone who's very interested in the philosophy of Buddhism and have worked very hard at going to classes and reading. But I may make mistakes, and I will do my best to give you correct information and not mislead you. But if I say something that's not correct, it's not because the Buddha Dharma is incorrect. It's because I am incorrect. But I'll try to avoid those problems. So, oh my goodness, what happened here? I don't understand what happened there. Well, I hope that's not going to happen for all the court. No? Just this one. Okay. Well, anyway, the Kadapa Center that's too distracting, so I'm going to leave it off. In the 1970s and 80s, Dr. Don Brown, who is the founder of the Kadampa Center, went over to India. He had just finished medical school, and like the other hippies of that time, he was searching for some greater meaning. And they all heard that over there in India, they had some deeply spiritual ways of finding meaning in life. And here in the United States, you know, the Vietnam War was going on, and there was all this materialism that a large group of people called the hippies just didn't find any quality in. So a lot of people, the Beatles and many other people, I'm sure some of us in this room remember that, maybe one or two with myself, but yeah, I'm sure you've all read about that. Prior to the 70s, Buddhism was really encapsulated in the Eastern cultures, in Tibet, China, Japan, Burma, Taiwan, Thailand, that part of the world. And really very little bit of it had come over to the Western world. And essentially, it's really a very different way of thinking. We all have a sense that Eastern mode of thought and culture, it's very different from the Western, even if we might not know exactly why. We have a sense that it is, and there really are quite a few differences. And so when the hippies went over there to try and find some greater meaning in life, a few of them, including Dr. Don Brown, came upon this monk called Lama Yeshe. And I'm sorry that you can't really see the picture very well, but there's a picture of him up here on the left. Lama Yeshe was very interested in these hippies, unlike most of the other Buddhists over there in the Eastern culture, because most of them didn't believe that people in the West with a Western mindset could really appreciate and understand Buddhism. They felt like it would confuse them, or they just wouldn't do it right. They didn't think that Westerners could understand. But Lama Yeshe said, no, I really think actually they would be better students because they come from the West where there's a lot of material goods, material sufficiency, and they have learned that having the material goods of life is not all there is to the circus. So really, they might really be very good students of learning what is really important. So he and his co-worker, his co-monk, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, whose picture is also up here, and I'm sorry, most of you can't see, but there's pictures of him throughout. So Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa Rinpoche set out to work with the hippies, including Dr. Don Brown, and teach from some of the basics of Buddhism. And eventually, the students of Lama Yeshe, including Dr. Don Brown, came back to the United States and set up some centers, and Lama Yeshe came over, and Lama Zopa Rinpoche came over, and gradually the movement kind of built and trickled over here. Which just goes to show you that the presence of Buddhism in the Western world is really pretty new. Buddhism has been around for over 2,000 years, and it's really just taken root here in the West. Maybe just like in the past, how many years ago? It was the 70s. Not that long, right? 50, 60 years. So, let's see. I might look. So Dr. Don Brown started a little center. First, it was just a few people gathering in people's living rooms. Then a few more people came along. Then there were enough people that they had a friend who worked in real estate and found a deal to rent the basement of an office building on Chapel Hill Road. So they established the first Kadampa Center there in that basement room, and grew and grew, and as they grew, they invited teachers, Buddhist teachers who were traveling around like circuit preachers, you know, who go from one church to another to do teachings, and they invited a whole roster of teachers to come and teach them when they came through, and in between times, they just worked very hard to support one another, to teach one another, to read books and study. And then when there was enough people together, they asked Lama Zopa Rinpoche, I forgot to say that Lama Yeshe actually passed away in the 80s, the 1980s. So Lama Zopa Rinpoche took over. And so they asked Lama Zopa Rinpoche for our own teacher. And then in 1999, Geshe Gelug was agreed to come here to be our resident teacher. He knew not one word of English. He worked very, very hard to learn English and then learn English well enough to actually teach the Dharma, to teach Buddhism. And that's really a different, very different language. You have a question?
Yes. So I know that the Dalai Lama plays a significant role in Buddhism. Yes. Is there significance to the title of Lama as well?
Thank you for that question. The question was, he knows that Dalai Lama is very significant and that the title is significant, and is there any significance in the title Lama? Yes, there is. The word Lama means teacher. So almost anybody who has been studying like in a monastery or with highly qualified teachers might become a Lama sometime. A Geshe is an academic degree. Yes. I guess we might as well talk about that right here. Let me just finish about the Kadampa Center, and then I want to answer your questions, because they're very good ones. Thank you. So in 1990, they rented the room. In 1992, Dr. Robbie Watkins actually moved to the area. He was a colleague of Dr. Don Brown's, and Dr. Robbie Watkins is our center director and has been since 1990. So, let's see. Yeah. And then in 2007 is when we outgrew the basement and the office building and moved to here. Now, the Kadampa Center, and this is going to help incorporate those questions you had, which are very good ones. The Kadampa Center is part of the FPMT, Foundation for the Preservation of the Mahayana Tradition. Okay, which is the foundation that Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa Rinpoche founded. Now, what does that mean? Please come on in. The Foundation for the Preservation of the Mahayana Tradition. Tibetan Buddhism is part of the Mahayana tradition. There's Theravadin and Mahayana. And we're going to talk about those different branches of Buddhism next week, okay, or in subsequent classes. But because Buddhism is very new to the West, it's very, very important not to lose a lot in the translation. It's important that Buddhism moves with culture, okay, adapts to the culture of the people that are want to use the principles in their lives. But it's also important not to lose the essence. You've all probably experienced the translation of poetry or novels or movies from one language to another, and you know how the essence of a word in one culture can be really, really misunderstood in translation in another. So one of the reasons why this all looks the way it is, as you can tell, this is very much of the original Tibetan culture that Lama Yeshe, Lama Zopa Rinpoche are grounded in. And it's my understanding is it's a little bit like that little game of grapevine where if someone says something and you hear it from the source, you might have your own misinterpretations or misunderstandings from listening to the source person. But if this source person told someone else and told someone else, told someone else, told someone else, by the time you get to the end, you could be way off. And your misunderstandings are of misunderstandings of misunderstandings. So as part of the FPMT, the FPMT is an organization that really works hard to make sure that any of the teachings, any of the qualified teachers, not meaning just me, but the teachers that are here on Sundays, and doing teaching the Discovering Buddhism class, the more advanced class, that they hold to certain standards and have studied enough to fully understand the right interpretations of the teachings as possible. It is not an organization that gives us money. Everything that you see here, everything that you're feeling, it's 100% donated and volunteer work. So we don't get any money from that organization. They're just like a quality assurance kind of an organization. Now the Dalai Lama, who is the spiritual head of the Tibetan Buddhist branch, and again we're going to be talking more about the different branches of Buddhism in subsequent classes, but he is our ultimate spiritual director, our spiritual leader. And then he is also the spiritual leader of four different schools of Buddhism, including Tibetan Buddhism, that we are a part of. The real name for Tibetan Buddhism is the Gelugpa tradition, but it's easier for us to say Tibetan because it's the form of Buddhism that was propagated in Tibet. And this form of Buddhism is more academic than other branches. For example, like Zen Buddhism focuses more on introspection and meditation. Other branches might focus more on walking meditations or, you know, just different approaches. And the approach of Tibetan Buddhism, of which this center is a part of, is a more academic approach of studying and learning definitions and debate. Well, we don't do debate, but the teachers learn from debating. So the term Geshe is an academic degree that our resident monk, actually we now have two Geshes, that they have both achieved through years and years of study. A Geshe degree is the equivalent of a series of PhD degrees. It takes at least 25 to 30 years of intensive study to achieve that kind of a degree. So it's no small change. So let me see here if this next... Okay, so do we have any questions about Kadampa Center? Did I answer your question correctly? Yes.
Another question. So why was the name Kadampa chosen? What does it mean?
Well, thank you. That is a very good question. That when before Lama Zopa Rinpoche sent us a teacher, that Don Brown and the other members at that time asked Lama Zopa Rinpoche for a name for the center, because every center has its own name. There's Tishita, there's I don't remember the names of them, but he gave us the name Kadampa because Kadam means to take every word of the teachings as a way to be. And Pa is a place. Like this is a Gompa. This is a place for meditating. Okay? Okay, any other questions about the Kadampa Center or the teachers? Okay, thank you. All right, so in this class, when you see a little red star up there, it means that if you go to our website, to the Buddhism in a Nutshell class site, there's some handouts that you can look at or download and print if you want to. And there is a handout that describes the class. So I just thought I'd put that there for you. For your knowledge. So we're going to look at a general overview of the basic Buddhist philosophy of what Buddhism is, who the Buddha is, some of his teachings, and a brief introduction to meditation. This course alternates with another very basic course called Meditation 101, which is another 5-week course. Buddhism in a Nutshell goes for 5 weeks, 5 Tuesdays, but we are not going to have class on November the 3rd because it is a special Buddhist holy day and there's going to be activities going on in here. But if you forget and you come, you're most welcome to participate in the events of that evening. They will also start at 7 o'clock, I think. Most things in the evening start here at 7. So just because you're here doesn't mean we're going to be trying to convert you. Buddhism is one of the last organizations that will ever try to convert anybody. Because as Geshe Gelug, our teacher, says, the world does not need more Buddhists. What we need is more people with kind, good hearts. So our hope is that you're coming here and your interest in the way Buddhist thinking is that it might help you to learn some way to have a more peaceful heart, more peaceful mind, maybe some tools to help your life be a little more comfortable, more harmonious, and in turn, that will make the world a little bit better place, right? Okay. So, what is Buddhism? Is it a philosophy? Is it a religion? A culture? Who thinks it's a philosophy only? Or a philosophy? Yeah? A religion? Culture? And a lot of people have no opinion. Well, actually, it can be any of those things. Okay? Buddhism is about the mind. It's about a way of thinking and perceiving and interpreting life. It's about controlling the mind, controlling your mind. It's about developing a mind that is flexible, calm, compassionate, and wise. Doesn't that sound good? I'm still working on it. We encourage you to listen to what is said here each of these class nights and to think about it. Think about it as a theory. Do not accept it or reject it just simply on the words that come out. But just use it as a theory in your life and think about it, listen, think about it, test it out in your own life. If there's some little idea that just kind of seems to resonate with you, take that and apply it to your life and see if it's right for you. Now, it's very important to pay attention to the definition of some words. Like we were talking about before, when there's translations from one language or culture to another. It's very easy to misunderstand things. So if you're thinking of a word like, for example, mind or meditation or Buddha, we've all heard those words so many times. And each one of you probably have some idea in your head of what you think those words mean. You may be right or you may be wrong. But if you're thinking of that definition instead of really trying to understand how we are talking about it here in the class, you will get even more confused than you might be if you had an inkling of what we're really talking about. One teacher I heard said, it's sort of like the word sharp. Okay, what image comes in your head, the word sharp? Okay, you could be thinking of a very sharp knife. You could be thinking of someone who looks really sharp. But if you're talking about music and you think sharp means looking really nice and you say be sharp, it's going to be very confusing, right? So that's what I mean by when we talk about the words mind, meditation, Buddha, I will try to give a definition that is consistent with the Buddhist idea of it and try to hold that definition in your mind as we move along. So this here is a really nice little summary of really what Buddhism is all about by the Dalai Lama. The very purpose of religion is to control yourself, not to criticize others. Rather, we must criticize ourselves. How much am I doing about my anger, about my attachment, about my pride, my jealousy? These are the things which we must check in daily life. Taking your own body and mind as the laboratory, engage in some thorough research on your own mental functioning, and examine the possibility of making some positive changes within yourself. So that is the essence of the Buddhist philosophy. Okay, so the meaning in life. For endless time, people were trying to find the meaning of life, or still trying to think about it. Okay. So, who is the Buddha? So, first of all, it's important to know that the word Buddha means a fully enlightened or awakened being. And what that means is enlightenment, which is the ultimate goal of practice. It's attained when all limitations are removed from the mind and positive potential is fully realized. It's a state of infinite compassion, wisdom, and skill. So essentially, a Buddha is someone who has achieved perfect compassion and wisdom. Now, when you talk about the Buddha, we are mostly referring to the historical Buddha, who is Shakyamuni Buddha. Shakya was the clan of the historical Buddha, which is located in present-day Nepal, and Muni means sage. So this is what most people throughout the ages imagined that the Shakyamuni Buddha looked like. Okay, that was in his time and his status, what he would have looked like. Now, as I said, I really try to give you correct information. So, and the FPMT is our quality control. So I want to read you a little paragraph about who Shakyamuni Buddha is. Okay, so Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical founder of Buddhism, was born in India approximately 2,500 years ago. Shakyamuni Buddha was the son of the king of the Shakyas, a small tribe whose kingdom was located in the foothills of the Himalayas, south of what is now central Nepal. His birth name was Siddhartha Gautama. You've probably heard of the book Siddhartha by Hermann Hesse and many other books about Siddhartha. That's a novel, but it's based on the historical Buddha. 7 days after his birth, his mother Maya died, and he was raised by his mother's younger sister. His mother's death may have been a great influence upon the delicate youth, who later became very perplexed by the question of mortality. His father took good care of his introspective, quiet-mannered son and gave him special training in literature and martial arts. As a boy, Shakyamuni was deliberately shielded from the many realities of life, having brought up amid the pleasures of the royal palace. It was natural for his family to expect that he would take over as the leader of his tribe and succeed his father. Although his family had such expectations for him, Shakyamuni was extremely introspective and quiet as a youth, possessing a sharp sense of justice, seeking the answers to life's perplexing questions. It's said that he ventured out of the palace compounds on a number of occasions as a youth, and each time was confronted with the sufferings of life. On one such occasion, he came upon a very old man. On another adventure, he met a sick man, frail and burning with fever. On yet another journey, he was impressed when he met a wandering monk, also called a bhikshu, who had renounced the world to lead an austere life in search of spiritual enlightenment. And again on another occasion, he saw a person dead in the street. These events are recounted in the Buddhist scriptures as the four meetings. He was said to have been deeply moved by these confrontations with human suffering. Knowing his son's tendency toward deep introspection and his desire to seek a spiritual path, his father sought to tie him down to life within the confines of the palace and their land. Marriage seemed a way to dissuade the young prince from pursuing the life of an ascetic. So at the age of 16, the young prince married the beautiful Yashodhara and bore him a son, Rahula. Following the birth of his son, Shakyamuni could no longer repress the resolve he felt to abandon the secular world and go out in search of a solution to the four inescapable sufferings of birth, old age, sickness, and death. Siddhartha renounced secular life and his princely status around the age of 19 and began living a religious life. Having left the palace, the capital of the kingdom, where he studied with various ascetics, however, after following their disciplines, he still could not find the answers to his questions. He then left and proceeded to the bank of the river, where he began to practice various austerities in the company of other ascetics. He subjected himself to disciplines of extreme severity, surpassing the efforts of his companions, trying to reach emancipation through self-mortification. But after 6 years, he rejected these practices as well. To restore his strength from having fasted for such a long time, he accepted milk offered to him by a girl of the village. Then near the town of Gaya, he sat under a peepal tree and entered meditation. There he attained enlightenment at the age of 30. The peepal tree was later called the Bodhi tree because Shakyamuni gained Bodhi, or enlightenment, under this tree, and the site itself came to be called Bodhigaya. After his awakening, or enlightenment, Shakyamuni remained for a while beneath the Bodhi tree, rejoicing in his emancipation. Shakyamuni contemplated how he should communicate this realization to others. It said he questioned whether or not he should attempt to teach others that what he had achieved. He finally resolved to strive to do so that the way to liberation from the sufferings of birth and death would be open to all people. First, he made his way to the Deer Park in Varanasi, where he preached the Four Noble Truths to 5 ascetics who had once been his companions. Over the next 50 years, from the time of his enlightenment until his death, Shakyamuni continued to travel through many parts of India, disseminating his teachings. During his lifetime, his teachings spread not only to central India, but also to more remote areas, and people of all social classes converted to Buddhism. Now, I'm sure that everybody, or most of you, have heard some legends of the Buddha, of how he was a prince, and one day he went out and saw, you know, sickness, death, old age. So the legends, of course, are based in truth. And what I've read you here tonight is a little bit more of the rest of the story and makes it a little bit more believable because it's based in a little bit more fact. I always would felt very strange and wondering, like, how could a whole philosophy based on a guy who left his young wife and infant son, how could that be something good? But when you put it into the context of the history and the culture and the actual facts of how he was always that kind of a person, he didn't just like one day, he was, you know, a rich prince in a rich kingdom, spoiled with everything, and then one day he goes out and sees these things and it changes. Now, he was always a very introspective kind of person. There's a wonderful book that's written by Thich Nhat Hanh that is a biography of the Buddha. It's called Way of the White Cloud, I think, something like that. There's White Cloud in the title. And it's a detailed biography of the Buddha. And in it, he talks about how his wife was the very same kind of a person. As a child, she was someone, too, who was exceptionally kind and introspective and wondered about life. And so he knew that, and that is why he chose that particular woman to be his wife, because they both knew that someday he was going to have to pursue this hunger to know more. So even though they were all very sad the day that he felt he had to go on and learn more, it's not like he just, you know, deserted them. And in fact, later on in life, you know, after his being gone for a few years to achieve this knowledge, he did go back, and his son became one of his disciples when he was old enough, and chose to do so. So that's just a little of the rest of the story. Okay. Any questions so far? Okay. So, this is probably not what it looked like back when the Buddha was there, but this is Lumbini. This is the place where Prince Siddhartha was born 2,500 years ago and questioned the meaning of life and found no answers either in luxury, the luxury of his princely kingdom, nor in his severe deprivation as living as an ascetic. They say they survived on just a few drops of water and a grain of rice a day. That's a little hard to believe, so I can't really comment on that. But within the last year, National Geographic, I think, or the History Channel, had a special on how they have been excavating this land and think that they have actually found the burial place of the historic Buddha, Shakyamuni, Siddhartha Gautama. So this is historically accurate. There really was a clan of Shakyas and a place where this happened. Okay, Bodhigaya. This is, of course, that wasn't there. The Buddha was there. Okay, this is a big shrine that has been erected there to honor the place where for 6 years the Buddha sat and thought about how things exist. So this here is one of the main ways that Buddhism differs from most Christian faiths, and indeed many in even non-Christian faiths. In most faiths or spiritual philosophies, claim to be founded on divine enlightenment, like somebody was divinely inspired by someone and is just a vehicle for expressing that. The Buddha sat and thought about the natural order of things, how things really are. And the best analogy is something like Einstein and Stephen Hawking did not invent physics. They weren't divinely inspired to know what they do about physics. They sat and thought about the way things are, about how molecules and atoms and gravity and quarks and all those things that they talk about, how it works together. What are these secrets? They think about it. They build upon the knowledge. And just like the Buddha, that we have the Buddha, this historic Buddha, they are not the only ones who ever thought about these things. They're not probably not the first nor the last who discovered these natural laws of physics. But the reason that they are significant, just as the historic Buddha is significant, is because not only did they have the ability to sit and understand those things, but they have the ability to communicate them in a way that at least those of like mind are able to understand it. So at the time of the Buddha, there were other, most likely other Buddhas, other people who were enlightened. There were probably some before him. There are some after him. There's some now. There's many. But the key, the reason that he is so significant is like Einstein or Stephen Hawking, okay, they have the mental ability, capacity to understand these things and to communicate them to us. It takes a lot of effort, okay? He didn't just say, okay, I just want to know all these things, and it came to him in a snap. No, it's a lot of work. So, and same with Einstein and Stephen Hawking, you know, they didn't just like wake up one day and say, oh, you know, this is how gravity works. E equals MC squared, right? It takes a lot of work, a lot of discussion with other people, a lot of thinking, testing out. It's very important that any ideas that you extract from anything in this class or anything that you read about Buddhism or here in any of our classes, that you do not just take it on its word. Test it for yourself. That's a very essential part of Buddhism. That it's not just a way of thinking. It's a way of being. It's important to apply those things that you learn and apply them because you know them to be true for yourself. Okay, so the Buddha's first teaching was the Four Noble Truths. And that little star there means that you can go to the website and download information about it from the website. Okay? So, let me get my papers here. The Four Noble Truths. They are, first, suffering exists. We all know that. Two, it has a cause. It can be ended, and there's a path to end it. And the analogy, an analogy that's often used in teaching Buddhism, is you compare it to physical illness. Okay, that suffering, such as physical illness, has a diagnosis. It can be ended with a prescription, and there's a way to do it. Okay? Now, in Buddhism, suffering there's different kinds of suffering, and the two major categories of suffering are mental and physical suffering, and we all know that. And of the two, mental suffering is a lot more significant to us, in that it actually can affect the physical suffering as well. But mental suffering is mostly what we're talking about when we refer to suffering in Buddhism. So, suffering, there are three kinds of suffering that we talk about. First is the suffering of pain, which can be physical or mental. There's the suffering of change, and that means when we have something that is good, our youth, our health, a great dinner, a nice shirt, whatever, we expect that nice thing is never going to change. We might kind of know it on the edge of our brain that it's going to change, but we don't really want it to. We kind of deny that it's going to change. So when it does change, when that nice shirt gets old, or our youth starts turning to wrinkles, it causes us some pain. So it's really hard for us to accept change. And so that is one of the sufferings. And there's a third kind that we'll never be able to explain in this very brief course, but it's called the pervasive compounded suffering. And it's a very subtle kind of suffering that actually is the fact that we are all human beings on an earth and have to go through birth, illness, death, and all these other sufferings. It's just an all-pervasive suffering. And like I said, that's a definition that really requires a lot more information about other ideas in Buddhism. So I'm sorry, I don't feel like I'm explaining that one to you very well, but it's a little hard to understand. Even though I've been doing this for my 11, 12 years, it's still a little tough. But the point is, we all know that suffering exists, and we all know that it has a cause. But in Buddhism, like I said, we're talking more about the mental suffering, this mental, what we might call a spiritual suffering. So there are six root afflictions that Buddhism would say are the cause of suffering. Ignorance, anger, attachment, pride, doubt, and wrong view. These are qualities that are common to all human beings, and these are the qualities that cause us the suffering. And we will be talking about these different qualities in subsequent classes. The third noble truth, the cessation, the truth that it can be ended. There are ways. One of the essence, basic tenets of Buddhism that we'll talk again about in another class is that nothing stays the same. Everything changes. It's one of the causes of suffering, but it also is one of the causes of hope. Because if we couldn't change, then it'd be pretty hopeless, right? So, it can be ended. There is a way to change your mind, to change it out of the state of suffering into a state of peace and harmony. And there is a way to do it. And the way, one of the classes that is offered here to students who have been studying Buddhism for a long time is on Wednesday nights, the Lam Rim. The Lam Rim is the graduated path. It's sort of one of the an old textbook, a Buddhist textbook, I guess you could call it, a curriculum of ways to change your mind in steps. You start by thinking about, meditating about the precious human life and how things are interconnected, and it goes gradually step by step by step. So there are many different ways to learn about these things here at the Kadampa Center or through books. By the way, another very important thing is to make sure that if you're going to be studying Buddhism, that you use qualified sources. And in Buddhism, they say if you study and observe your teachers, make sure they are of quality and knowledge by observing them even up to 13 years. Now, we don't all have that amount of time, or maybe not want to take that amount of time, but there are many teachers that we know are qualified, like His Holiness the Dalai Lama. So if you're wondering if should you take this book versus that book, and one is written by or endorsed by the Dalai Lama, you can feel pretty confident that that book is authentic and will lead you to the right place, versus another one that might be very good, but you can't be very sure of it unless you've studied that person for a long time. Okay, so the Buddha, the place of Kushinagar is where the Buddha passed into parinirvana, which means, it's a fancy way of saying his body died. Okay, and it was the ultimate teaching on nirvana. Now, one of the reasons why learning about the historic Buddha is really helpful to us is to realize that he was just a human being like all of us. And he is just one example of someone who was a human being who achieved this great compassion and wisdom. So it shows us that we also can achieve that. And he physically died just like all of us are going to. He was born, he lived, and he died just like all of us, and yet he was able to achieve these things as all of us can. So who is the Buddha? This was one of the best definitions that I ever saw on who the Buddha is. He's neither a divinity nor a supreme chief. He's a most venerable personage, for he's the embodiment of immense compassion and infinite wisdom. This is a definition that I saw. There was a Jade Buddha for Universal Peace that was on tour a few years ago, this really beautiful piece, and that quote was around the statue. Okay, so are there any questions so far about the Buddha, the historic Buddha, the Kadampa Center, anything? Because we're going to move on here to a little bit of meditation, talking about meditation. No? All right. So, meditation. What does it mean to you? And our teacher, Geshe Gelug, often says, there is no teaching that says you must meditate. It's only said that if you do, it will help you. So that's something that I thought was pretty important, because a lot of people think, oh, if you're Buddhist, you just have to meditate, right? Buddhism is all about meditating. Well, what does meditation mean to you? It's very much all over in the newspapers. Last year there was a Parade magazine dedicated to the number one health booster in 2015. Politicians, children, and celebrities are doing it. Shouldn't you? And look at all these people who meditate. Oprah, Paul McCartney, all these very famous people all meditate. And so it's become a cultural thing, hasn't it? So what does meditation mean to you? Any volunteers? Quiet group tonight, right? I understand. Well, yes.
Although,
yeah.
The way I see it is there's different ways to meditate.
Okay.
It's just a way of quieting the mind if you can, and there's different ways initiate that process.
Mm-hmm.
Once you start to quiet the mind, you take some time, and eventually sort of depart meditation with a little bit more relaxed demeanor.
So the definition is it's a way to quiet the mind, and then it helps you to feel more calm after you've done that. Very good. That's very good. And that is definitely one aspect of meditation. Anybody else? You know, I think maybe we ought to do a microphone so everybody can hear. You don't need it? Okay. I was trying to repeat. Okay. Very good. So another part of meditation is to quiet yourself, to look inside, try and understand what's going on inside of you and how you relate to the outside, and to notice more what is outside of you and how it affects you as well. Right. Is that correct? Very good. So in Buddhism, the word... Well, let me first say that one idea of meditation that many people... I've known, think of it as a way of emptying your mind. And in Buddhism, we say it is impossible to empty your mind. It is impossible to think of nothing. The word meditation in Tibetan Buddhism comes from the Tibetan word gom, G-O-M. This is a gompa, a place where meditation occurs. And the word gom means to become familiar with. So meditation in Buddhism is a way to become familiar with yourself, your feelings, but mostly it's a way to become familiar with the ideas, the thoughts that will make you a more peaceful, compassionate person. So in order to do that, the very first step is to be able to focus your mind, to quiet your mind, as this young man said. It's important to be able to calm yourself down, to focus your thinking. So let's see here. Okay. Yeah, okay. So the definition, it means to become familiar with. Now our teacher Geshe Gelug says there are three kinds of meditation: concentration, review, and analysis. And many sources combine these into two, the absorption and the analysis. But Geshe Gelug said, starts with concentration so that we can understand this process a little better. Most of us have what's called in Buddhism the monkey mind. Now, it just jumps from one thought to another. It's really hard for us. We're so used to multitasking. We're checking our emails while we're listening to the television, or we're in a meeting and we're checking our voicemails, and you know, we're just so scattered. And we think that we're accomplishing a lot of things, and on the surface we may be, but that really leaves our essence, our insides, our minds very tangled and scattered. So it's really important to try to change that, to be more aware of what we are doing, what we are thinking, what we are experiencing. So the first thing we need to do is to teach our minds to stop swinging in the trees and to focus down. So that is probably where the most common idea of what meditation means comes from, because the first step is to sit quietly, to focus on one thing, to train your mind to focus, not to train your mind to empty out. That's not possible. But it is possible to train your mind to focus on one thing. Now, the traditional way to do that is to focus on the breath. Some people say, well, I really prefer to focus on the flame of a candle or the sound of a bell or music or the birds. It's okay to do all those things, any of those things. Whatever works for you is okay. But there is a good reason why we choose the breath, and it's because the breath is always with you. So if you train yourself to use a tool that you always have available, you will have it at the ready anywhere at any time. It's very important for you to know that when we talk about different things that we do, like meditation, that you understand the reason for it. It's very important to not just do something because it's the thing to do, because it's the ritual. You must, in our branch of Buddhism especially, it's important to understand why you are doing it. And if you can't explain to yourself why you are doing it, then maybe you should not be doing it, because then you're just going through the motions of something. So we're going to, so we're going to talk about why we do the different kinds of meditation that we're going to be learning here. Some of you have already taken the Meditation 101 class, a couple of you, so you might already know these things, but most people haven't. And this is just, this is very, very basic introduction, much more basic than the Meditation 101 that does it for 5 weeks, but I'll give you a little taste of it here. Okay, so we talked about the monkey mind. In Buddhism, you will see different symbols of the elephant around, okay? The elephant is a symbol of the mind because it's very powerful. The mind is a very big and powerful thing. And meditation means you use mindfulness, a focusing of your attention, as a rope to gather the elephant and tie it to an object to start to control it. It's an image that's used. There's a tanka. These drawings here are called tankas, T-H-A-N-G-K-A, the tankas. And they are tools to teach their traditional tools, like stained glass windows were in churches, okay? And there's a tanka in the other room that looks like a winding pathway, and you'll see there's one at the bottom. There's somebody with it chasing an elephant, okay, and a monkey, you know, and he's chasing them. He has no control of his mind, and that monkey is just leading him all over the place. And gradually, as he works up the path of the path, he gets more and more control of the elephant and the monkey. And at the end, he is riding the elephant and has complete control over the monkey. And that's all symbolism of getting control of your own mind. So, the traditional way to meditate is by using the 7-point meditation posture, and there is a handout online that you can refer to. And there are reasons for all of these things. The most important thing is find a way that you can be comfortable for whatever period of time you can choose. And Geshe Gelug says it's better to meditate for 1 minute or 5 minutes each day than to try to start and do 30 minutes and just feel like it's torture. Okay, start small, start what works for you, and use whatever tools are helpful to you. But again, if you start by using the correct tools, it will be to your advantage later as you grow more and more into it. So I'm going to be teaching you showing and trying to explain to you what the traditional way is, because there's over 2,000 years of practice that shows that this works, okay? So the seven-point meditation posture is, first of all, if you're sitting in a chair, it's important that your feet are grounded, flat on the floor, not just swinging. So those of us with short legs, I usually have to put a cushion under my feet. This chair fits me a little better. But if you're sitting in a chair, make sure your feet are grounded. It's important to have your back straight, and it's really ideal to not even be leaning it against the back. Believe it or not, Western chairs are conducive to very poor posture. This is not the natural way that the spine wants to be sitting, which is why so many office workers have terrible backs. So if you're sitting in a chair for meditation, it's actually helpful, I have found, to have like a small towel or roll that you put at the base of your spine to lift your hips a little bit from the back. And what the reason for that is that your spine can then be stacked up in a nice straight line and support itself. The human skeleton is actually made to, if you're in proper posture at rest, it can support itself upright. But the way we sit in chairs doesn't do it. If you're sitting on a cushion, have your legs crossed. Some people do the full lotus with the feet up. I can't do that. Many people can't. But to have your legs crossed in a comfortable position. But again, if you're sitting on a cushion, it's very helpful, almost critical, to have the cushion be thicker at the very base of your spine, so you're sloping forward just a little bit so that your spine can be in straight alignment. I'm amazed all you guys can be sitting on the cushions for this long, and you're probably not used to it, are you? If you get tired, it's really okay to move. Okay. All right, so legs should either be crossed if you're on the floor or flat on the floor if you're in a chair. Arms, they suggest that your arms be a little bit away from your body so that air can pass through. Now, that might not seem like a really critical issue if you're sitting for 3 minutes or 5 minutes, but the hope is that eventually you can find yourself sitting for longer and longer periods of time. And if you're sitting for a long period of time and your arms are too tight against you, first of all, you won't be in a comfortable posture. Your shoulders will probably be slumping. And also, it doesn't allow air to pass through and provide comfort. We already talked about the back, how it's very important to have that straight. Your eyes, they suggest that eventually your goal would be to have your eyes almost closed, but just just open enough to let in a little bit of light. And that's so that if your eyes are completely closed, that's conducive to getting sleepy. And if your eyes are all the way open, it's more conducive to being excited or wanting to look around. I find that, and most people find it's very, very hard to have your eyes open just a little tiny bit. So at first, you might want to just close your eyes softly, and then as you go on, maybe you can practice letting in a little bit of light or looking at something with kind of out of focus in front of you. Your jaw and your mouth, you should not have your jaw clenched tight. It should be relaxed. Your mouth softly closed. And your tongue should be resting on the palate of your mouth, the roof of your mouth, just behind your teeth. The reason for that is because after a long period from breathing in and out of your mouth might get dry, and that keeps your mouth more moist, prevents you from drooling too. The scheduler says, so the precious jewels won't dribble out your mouth. He's a funny guy. Okay. And your head should be slightly tilted, not too far back. That will throw you off balance. Too far forward will make you want to tumble into sleep. So that's the reason for this posture. Are there any questions? Okay. So we're going to do a little beginning meditation. And this is also available to you online. We're going to do a relaxing and scanning the body. So do your best. Yes. Thank you very much. I forgot to mention that the position of the hands. Yes, thank you. In our tradition, the way we hold our hand, we cup the left hand and then the right hand in it, and we hold it at the navel. And this helps our arms to be in the right position. Okay? Now, other traditions or other preferences are maybe holding their hand in certain mudras. They call them mudra, different hand symbols. And that's fine, too. People are more comfortable holding their hands on their knees. Okay? But in our tradition, we put the right palm into the left and touch our thumbs at about the navel height. Okay? Thank you for that question. Okay. So, relaxing and scanning the body. Focus your attention on your breathing. Breathe naturally. Become present in the moment and place where you are. Just focus the mind on the rising and falling of your shoulders and chest as you inhale and exhale gently. Allow your mind to settle and become calm and present, ready to engage in meditation. Create an altruistic motivation for the meditation session. Think that you are meditating not just for your own individual benefit, but you are taking the time now to meditate and develop your mind to become a wiser and kinder person, able to be of benefit to all beings. Focus your attention on your physical body. Find the most suitable sitting position for your meditation with your spine straight and erect, a position in which you can be aware and awake, but not stiff or rigid. Focus your attention on the top of your head. Move down. Through the head, the skull, the back of the head, the ears, releasing any tension in your brow. Move down through your face, checking the jaw to see if you're holding or clenching any tension there. Just keep a normal, natural breath moving through your system while you do this. Each time you exhale, just relax a little bit more into this posture, letting go any tension or any anxiety. Moving down through the neck and shoulders where a lot of our tension is stored, checking these areas. And down through the arms, elbows and wrists, and the hands and fingers, letting go of anything you're holding there. Move down through your torso, releasing any tension from your back, your chest, just breathing into it, your waist and your hips, your buttocks, releasing the tension in your thighs, your knees, just breathing into any discomfort you may feel there, expanding the space that is there. Release any tension in your legs, your ankles, and feet and let go all the way out through your toes. Take a moment now to focus on the lowermost part of your body that comes into contact with your cushion or chair. And feel the substance of your body as it makes that contact. Feel the weight and substance of this physical form. Note places where one part of your body is touching another. Note any discomfort you may feel in your body. Just notice this. There's no need to fix things or have judgments or opinions. We're just noticing as we scan the body. And as you notice, you can see if you can bring a bit more relaxation, a bit more of the breath into those places. You can note your breathing, the movement of the abdomen or the chest as the air is moving in and moving out. Notice the curve of the arms, the shoulders, the body. Relax and take a deep breath. Release any lasting tension. Finally, dedicate your positive energy and insights to the well-being and happiness of all living beings. Thank you for participating in that. So I hope that gives you a little sense of how it's important to first relax your physical body and calm your mind and try and focus. And this first step helps you to focus on all of your body. And another way of focusing is a meditation called counting the breaths. And it's quarter after. We won't go through one of these, but I'll explain that when you are doing a meditation of counting the breaths, you first put yourself in the 7-point posture, and then you take a deep breath out, and then in. That's one, and out. Then in, two, and out. You do the counting on the in-breath. And it is said that if you can get to 21 without losing any focus on every in and out breath, that you will find that it will give you a clear mind. And on number 4 or 7, you might lose count, lose focus. You might start thinking, oh, number 7, oh, I got a paper due now tomorrow. I hope we get in on time. 8, oh, I forgot that I didn't turn off the coffee pot. You know, if those thoughts intrude, you start over at 1. So it takes a long time to be able to get to 21 without any distractions. But you can do it. So this cartoon here, I know that most of you can't read all the words, so I think it's a really good illustration of how we all feel. It's important to just relax and be good to yourself. Know that you're just starting. Take it easy. Start 30 seconds, 2 minutes at a time, whatever works for you. And don't make it into a job. Don't criticize yourself over it. It's something new and different. Just take care. So this poor little guy is sitting here thinking, just keep breathing. Is it possible to die of itchiness? I guess I'm about to find out. I can hear at least 250 of them. Ah, I categorically refuse to move. This is not my idea of a good way to donate blood. So this is the path to liberation. So there's a mosquito surrounding his head. So the important lesson is to be kind to yourself. Are there any questions about anything we talked about tonight? Okay. No question? Okay. Well, it's only 8:15, but I know nobody's ever complained about leaving a little bit early. So we'll always try to start on time and leave enough time at the end that if there's questions that we can talk about things and that you could still get out on time. And I'm always available after class if you have individual questions. And you can always email me also if you have questions. Again, this is the first of 5 weeks of Buddhism in a Nutshell. With the exception of on November the 3rd, we're going to skip a week, okay? And tonight was just a bare introduction. I hope that I have explained things at least well enough for you to be interested in coming back again. But if not, I certainly understand, and that's fine. So next week, we're going to talk more about the history of Buddhism. And we're going to talk about the Buddhist view of mind. In the subsequent classes, we're going to get more into what the philosophy is, okay, of Buddhism. We're going to talk more about meditation, more about the Four Noble Truths, and what it means to be a Buddhist. Now, next week, I know that the State Fair is going to be happening, but on a Tuesday, it's generally not like it is on Thursday and Friday and the weekends, okay? So I live downtown and I travel on Hillsborough Street all year long when there's students and not students, when there's state fairs and not state fairs. And I found that the police really do quite a good job of ushering the traffic. So although it might be slower, it's not impossible. And you don't have to pay for parking when you come here for class. And after class, you might even be able to walk down there and see the fireworks. So don't let the fair discourage you from coming next week, but I certainly understand if it does. Important for you to know about handouts and links. The handouts that we talked about, you just go to the Kadampa Center website. Under Spiritual Programs, you'll see Buddhism in a Nutshell. There is Buddhism in a Nutshell book available in the bookstore, and it's a little bit more in-depth because you could read it, and there's also a CD, an audio CD in there as well. So if you want a supplement to this, you can do that. And you could also join our email list by going to our website, and that will give you official announcements about anything that's going on here at the center, and if there's any last-minute changes in this class, which is probably not as important now because it's not winter, but like last year, we had to cancel classes because of weather, so it was important to get the announcements. As Jill said, you know, it's this place is completely on a donation basis, so if you find that you've found any value in here, I kind of think of giving back to the Kadampa Center as an investment. This place would not be here for me, for any of us, if people before us did not invest either some money, whether a little bit or whatever they can afford, their time, their dedication. So if you find that you are able to give back to whatever extent you feel that you got tonight, it is all very much appreciated. So thank you all so much for coming tonight, and I hope to see you next week. Good night.